have quite a few sharp memories, but then also my mother was an avid letter writer. And two or three times a week, she would write these long, lengthy letters to my grandmother, her mom, back to the US. And some of them would be published in the local Nashville papers. So what I couldn't remember quite vividly, I was able to draw on from her notes, her letters that my grandmother preserved and I got a hold of.
Welcome to Writes for Women, a podcast all about celebrating women's voices and supporting women writers. I'm Pamela Cook, women's fiction author, writing teacher, mentor, and podcaster. Before beginning today's chat, I would like to acknowledge and pay my respects to the Dharawal people, the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, along with the traditional owners of the land throughout Australia. And a quick reminder that there could be strong language and adult concepts discussed in this podcast, so please be aware of this if you have children around. Let's relax on the convo couch and chat to this week's guest.
Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of Writes for Women. It is Tuesday, March 5, as I'm recording this, and I have a fabulous interview for you today coming up with Catherine Abdul-Baki about her memoir, Dancing into the Light. It was an absolute joy to read this fantastic memoir and to speak to Catherine a few weeks ago. And there is so much in here about the memoir writing process, as well as a really beautiful story about her experience of growing up between two cultures. Her mother was an American and her father was Arab. And when Catherine was four, they moved over to the Middle East, and a lot of her childhood memories come from that part of the world. And it's a lovely story about her experience of dance and how that came out of her childhood. And then she weaves this beautiful thread of dancing throughout this memoir. Thank you to everybody who has been listening to and supporting the podcast. I've had some great feedback on this year's episodes. Huge shout out to Annie Bucknell, who is my virtual assistant, is doing a fantastic job on the socials. So thank you so much, Annie. And an absolute thank you to all the Patreon supporters. If you'd like to support the podcast for the cost of a cup of coffee per month or less, you can do that by going to writesforwomen.com and having a look on the Patreon page, and it will take you to the right links there. But thank you so much to all those people who are doing that already. And thank you to everybody who is writing reviews and telling us how much you enjoy the episodes. And of course, that just pushes the podcast up higher in the rankings, just as a book on Amazon goes up higher with more reviews. So thank you for those people who are doing that. And please think about that if you do enjoy an episode, popping a review up onto wherever it is you listen, whatever platform. This week I have, in personal writing news, just very quickly, I finished the edits on Out of the Ashes. So that has now gone off to my publisher at Belinda to be narrated, and it will be available from May 1, I believe, or sometime in May. And I am very soon starting the writing of the third installment of that Blackwater Lake series, which will be out later in the year, hopefully on audio. One thing that I always have trouble with, and it doesn't matter how many times I tell myself I'm not going to have trouble with it, is the timeline. I did try and keep track of that using the Plotter app, Plotter, and that went some way towards helping. But I got to Friday afternoon, I'd finished the edit and realised that yeah, there could be a little bit of a trouble with the timeline. I just had a brainwave, and this is probably a brainwave that other people have had before me, but hopefully it might be a tip that helps some people out there manage timelines at that editing and revision stage when you really want to double check something. I knew that I had written throughout the manuscript in various places, often at the beginning of a chapter or maybe not, maybe elsewhere. It had been 6 weeks since the fires or 3 weeks since she came back or whatever it was. So I thought I will do a search, a word search on the word weeks. And I have to say that was absolutely a godsend for me. It allowed me to find all the spots in the manuscript where it referred to a certain number of weeks. And it did bring up, or did show me and highlight a little bit of a glitch that I had. I was able to find that and then to tweak that and then to fix it. A little bit of a tip there, never ever underestimate the find slash search function. If you're looking for a particular phrase or you want to know a particular thing that a character said at a certain time, if you can think of a word or phrase that may have been used at that point, type it into the search bar at the top if you're in Word. Scrivener also has a similar function. I was in Word by this stage because it was the final copy. But yeah, found that to be a real boon and helped me enormously. So hopefully that is a little tip that might help some people out there. Let me tell you a little bit about today's guest, Catherine Abdul-Baki. She was born in Washington, D.C. to a Palestinian father and an American mother and grew up in Iran, Kuwait, Beirut and Jerusalem, where she attended Arabic, British and American schools. She attended the American University of Beirut in Lebanon for 2 years and earned a BA in journalism from George Washington University and has an MA in creative writing from George Mason University in Virginia. Catherine worked as a journalist and a features writer for an English weekly newspaper in Bahrain before devoting her time to writing fiction. Her published works include a collection of short stories, 4 novels, and her memoir, Dancing into the Light. She won the Mary Roberts Reinhardt Award for short fiction, and her novel, Sands of Zuleiki, was a finalist for the Ariadne Prize. Her books are taught at universities in multicultural literature and Arab studies departments, and she's a frequent lecturer at universities and schools on these subjects. Catherine loves to dance and teaches and performs Argentine tango in the Washington, D.C. area. As I said, this was a fantastic chat with Catherine. I really enjoyed meeting her on the podcast and I loved reading her memoir. Sit back, grab a cuppa, pop on your walking shoes, whatever it is that you do while you listen to Rights for Women, and enjoy this chat with Catherine. So, Catherine Abdul-Baki, welcome to the Rights for Women Convo Couch.
Thank you. My pleasure to be here.
It's really lovely to have you. And you're coming to us all the way from, is it Washington, D.C.?
Yes, Virginia, outside of Washington.
Fantastic. And that rang a bell with me, of course, because having read your memoir, I know that's where the story starts with your parents, but we're going to get into that in a little while. Before we do get into talking about Dancing into the Light, could you tell us about your path to publication, Catherine, because you have written quite a few books yourself. You've been writing for a long time. And I'd love to know, when did you first know that you wanted to write and how did that lead you on your journey to becoming a writer?
Thank you. I always knew I wanted to write from the age of 12 on. My father gently suggested one day when I asked him what I should be when I grow up, he said, be a writer. My mother had been a writer. So for some reason that stuck in my head. And I tended to like the arts and the humanities, so that I picked that up and went to journalism school. And then later on, after practicing journalism for a while, I got my master's in creative writing. And that's when I started to write fiction mainly. So I've written a collection of short stories called Fields of Fig and Olive. And then I've written 4 novels, mostly set in the Middle East, mostly with Arab characters, but the previous last novel was with American characters who travel all over the world, including the Middle East. And this is my first ever memoir. So it's my 6th book, but my very first nonfiction effort.
Yeah, I'm interested to talk to you about that and the timing of the memoir and where it's come in your journey of being a writer. And obviously, you've drawn a lot in your writing on your own experiences in growing up in the Middle East and being a child of an American mother and a Middle Eastern father. And of course, that's what the memoir is all about. It's about growing up between two cultures. And I also found that it was very much about coming to grips with and exploring grief, which is something that I really want to talk to you about too. But having written for a very long time, written fiction, delved into your own experiences, but in a fictional form, what was it that brought you to the point where you thought, I really want to write a memoir, I want to write about my own life?
I came to that very late. When I first published my first book of short stories, I had a lot of early memories in those stories, little stories of people, vignettes. But I was asked on 1 or 2 radio shows when I was on, why don't you write a memoir? Why did you choose to write fiction? Because they're so memoir. And back then, this was over 30 years ago, I thought memoirs were written by elderly people who had seen it all and wanted to encompass their whole lifetime. I felt I was way too young to write a memoir. But memoir has changed, and now you can simply write a memoir of 1 year of your life or 6 months of your life. Or so I suddenly wanted to write a memoir of my current life, which includes dancing. I teach dancing and how I combine that with writing. But the more I went back to the origins of the dance world in my life and where I first started dancing, it took me back to my early years and in Tehran and dancing with my parents. And as I flitted back and forth, present life, dancer, writer, past life, it got a little confusing. And a couple of my early readers said, why don't you just try writing it linearly, just go straight from the beginning? So I ended up doing that, which I think made it for more of a story. And as you probably know, that juxtaposed here and there little bits about my current dance life. But mostly it is a story of my life growing up in the Middle East and tended to be much more than just about dancing.
Yeah, very much. And I really want to talk about that dancing thread with you later. So it's interesting that was the kind of impetus for the story in a way, because the book does start and end with dance. But I want to get onto that later. I don't want to spoil too much of the story for listeners, but it does start with the meeting of your parents. First of all, I'd love for you to tell us about how your parents first met. I just found the whole story of your parents' relationship and everything just so fascinating. So I'd love for you to just to give us that little bit of a snippet of story. And also maybe to, once you did land on the fact that you were going to write a kind of more linear story about your growing up, what was it that made you decide on that point as the beginning of the story in a way?
I always envisioned that opening, which is a dance scene that takes place in a nightclub, and why it was that I was drawn to certain kinds of men who danced a certain way. And so I create that scene as a prologue, and that was always in the book for some reason. And then from there, was I attracted to that kind of dancing? And all of that took me way back to the very beginning. And I then focused on how my parents met, what it was about my father that drew my mother, what it was about him that drew him to dance. And then from there, I just went chapter by chapter through my life, trying to pick out the parts that really affected me over the course of my life, my growing up, because it does stop at a certain point, childhood, but later childhood.
So that's an interesting kind of, I guess, process of memoir writing too, isn't it? Because you could draw on so much. It's like your whole life, like you say, but obviously you decided to have those parameters of, you started with the background of when your parents met, and then we go into your arrival in Tehran as a four-year-old, and then you're growing up in that part of the world. How did you decide what those boundaries were? Did you work that out as you were writing, or when you started out, was it like, okay, I'm going to start here and I'm going to end there because that's just that part of the story I want to tell?
What was helpful was having this theme of dancing. I will say that was very helpful. You can pick any theme you want in addition to just the sequence of events. That always grounded me, brought me back to what it was I was trying to say. So when I start with the dancing, then how my parents met, and I tried to infuse that with a little bit of dancing, then how when we went to Tehran, that carried over in the dancing there. Then when we moved to Kuwait, that carried on in the dancing there. How after the traumas that happened in my young life, the dancing pulled me up. How that carried over the dancing also when I visit my Arab family in Jerusalem, my Palestinian family, and how dancing was such a big part of their life, as well as the expat community in which I lived in Kuwait. And so the dancing really helped me pick and choose what I wanted to put in. Of course, there were other things as well, but that really grounded me, kept bringing me back to the major theme and what I was trying to say about music and dancing and how that affected me and lifted me up from the experiences I had as a young child.
Yeah. And of course, your parents met in Washington.
Yes.
That's right, isn't it? Which is not that far from where you're speaking to us now. Tell a little story about how your parents met and your mother's kind of role in really encouraging the relationship.
Well, my father was he finished his undergrad and was working on his master's and had moved to Washington, D.C., where he had one or two jobs at the time. But one of the jobs was moonlighting at night, not moonlighting, but it was a job as a cashier in a Middle Eastern deli. And my mother had dropped out for a year from a prestigious school in the Midwest, Northwestern, and decided she was going to go to Washington and take a break and see what the real life was like before going back to school. And in those days, people smoked. And so she walked in with a roommate of hers, a girlfriend, into the deli where my dad was working. And she was always very, very outgoing and very much wanting to see the bigger world than the one she had come from, in which was outside of Nashville, Tennessee. And the moment she saw my dad at the time, she just thought, this is something I'm looking for. Anyway, he was young and handsome, and she could tell from an exotic place. So she pushed a little bit here and there and encouraged him to go out and with her. And my father, being very proper, coming from a Palestinian Muslim family from Jerusalem, the holy city, everything is done in certain ways. But he enjoyed being encouraged, and they essentially eloped at one point because she felt that her family was not going to sanction their wedding. So they eloped, and then they told her parents that it was a fait accompli, and everyone had to accept it.
I love that. And it sounded like, obviously, there would have been a bit of shock horror at the beginning, but it sounded like both sides of the family really, you know, it didn't take them that long to embrace their in-laws, their son-in-law and their daughter-in-law.
Once they met everybody, once my American grandparents met my father and saw that he was really a very honorable kind of person, and once my grandfather got over the fact that his son was not going to marry a young Arab woman, married a foreign woman, which is every parent's nightmare when they send their children far.
Yeah.
But once everybody settled down, they really had a very nice gathering. Everyone appreciated everybody else's culture and religion.
That's
everyone got along.
That really struck me, actually, as I was reading the book, Catherine, was the kind of level of acceptance and embracing of the other culture, particularly for your mother when she went to live in what would have been such a different and quite shocking at times culture.
Yes.
Of course, having an expat community would help with that, but she really embraced, didn't she, the cultures that she went into?
She was just in heaven because she always wanted to explore and get out. She had this big wanderlust in her, and she loved being in Tehran. Of course, in those days, it was during the Shah, and the Iranians with whom they mixed were very worldly and sophisticated, and their lifestyle there was one of an expat lifestyle. It's well catered to. And then when they moved to Kuwait, or when she met my father's family, they were very worldly also from Jerusalem. They'd been exposed to centuries, not those people, but say decades of international travelers. And so they were not closed-minded at all. So once they settled into the fact that this marriage was indeed happening and it was a good thing, everyone accepted her. And she knew how to just go into a culture, accept it. She never, in those days, was a lot less, say, rigid than what it is today, interestingly enough, 50, 60 years ago. People were much more open, and it was during a very peaceful time, let's say, in general. So she had a wonderful time living there. And never wanted to come back, and not as she loved the United States and she loved to come back and visit. But in terms of living, she really loved the warmth and the culture of living overseas. Yeah.
Now that definitely comes through in the storytelling. And you, of course, were four when your family moved to Tehran. How vivid are your memories of that time? Because I imagine there must have been some gaps in your memories. How did you go in terms of writing about that younger period of your life in those early years of living over there?
Actually, I have such vivid memories. I was an only child, so that's one thing. I didn't have any distractions around me. So
Yeah.
a lot of people had asked me, "How are your memories so sharp?" I have quite a few sharp memories, but then also my mother was an avid letter writer. And two or three times a week, she would write these long, lengthy letters to my grandmother, her mom, back to the US. And some of them would be published in the local Nashville papers because people were interested in what was
Fantastic.
going on overseas. So, what I couldn't remember quite vividly, I was able to draw on from her notes, her letters that my grandmother preserved and I got a hold of. So, but in general, the memories that I relate are generally my memories. I was there for 2 years, from 4 to 6. So some of them are hazier than others. But yeah, I was able to fill in the gaps with those letters.
So fantastic that your grandmother kept those letters too. Like it's such a
Oh, yes.
valuable family history, isn't it?
It is. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. And then from Tehran, you moved to Kuwait. Is that right?
We did. Yeah, we moved to Kuwait, where my dad then went to work for an oil company. And in Kuwait at that time, I'm talking 1958, it was literally where we were outside of town, about an hour out of the city. It was simply a desert with a jetty, a pier, and an oil refinery, and houses for expats who were mainly British or American. I think we had one Australian family as well. But so it was really a very different. Now, that was extremely different from being in cosmopolitan Iran, Tehran at the time. So this was something totally different. But we were right on the beach on this. So that was a lovely diversion we had.
Yeah, it
And
sounded amazing. I love the
it
little
was.
bit where you're flying in with your father and he says, "Oh, there, I've got you a sandbox." And of course, the sandbox was the desert.
Much too big of a sandbox. I can still feel the disappointment looking hard to find this little tiny sandbox and finding then it was the whole desert. I still feel that
Amazing.
pain.
And I have to say,
Yeah.
Catherine, as a horse lover, I live on a property with horses and I ride.
Oh.
So I
Oh,
really
wow.
enjoyed your father. I'll let you tell the story of your father's original connection to horses and then how he then got back into that when after you moved.
That's wonderful that you enjoy horses. He used to, in the US at one point, he went to the University in New Mexico and he worked to pay his tuition. He worked on a ranch. And so he might have known how to ride a little bit, but he learned how to ride well there, working with horses and being a cowhand, a cowboy, essentially. So when he went to, oh, in Tehran, they also belonged to something called the Officers Club, which was for American families of military people. And he, although wasn't with the military, but being expats, they joined that. And they had a weekly ride where a lot of people would just don their riding gear and go out over the beautiful Iranian countryside and ride. And so he did that once a week. And then when they went to Kuwait, he and our next door neighbor, who was from Texas, obviously, decided that the two of them were going to find horses and each of them was going to buy a horse. And they had some Bedouins coming up from further in the desert who were horse breeders, and they brought them two horses. And my father took it up again. And so that was a big part because the desert was totally flat in Kuwait. It was that kind of desert, totally flat. And we had the beach, so there was plenty of room just to ride, and there was very little other than that to really entertain adults, really. Eventually, people built a kind of little sandy golf course, but other than the
Right.
golf and the beach and the horses, that was really what expats did. So,
Did you
yeah.
continue riding as you grew older? Did you ride in your adult life?
I didn't ride my adult life because I think, as I mentioned in the book, I had a pretty severe fall when I was 9. Now I continued to ride after that. But later on, as an adult, I gave that up.
It's
Yeah.
amazing what fear kicks in as an adult that you to be able to get over when you're younger, but yeah, as an adult, it's not so easy.
Also in Kuwait, the terrain was soft, right? So we were riding on the beach and riding on the sand. And so it was very different when I moved to other places where,
Yeah, true.
there's a little bit, yeah.
Beautiful memories, though, isn't it? Like to be able to have
Yeah.
those memories of.
Oh, I love horses. And one of my daughters rode for many years.
Okay.
So I was able to vicariously continue it through
Yeah,
her.
your father would have loved that too.
Yes, he did.
We did talk initially a little bit about the memories and your vivid memories and being an only child. And I guess being in such a exotic place and somewhere so different to where you come from would have really cemented some of those memories in. But as you're writing a memoir like this, how did you go about when there were gaps? You had your mother's letters, you had your own memories, and no doubt family stories that you could draw on. How do you, as a memoirist, approach that difficulty of, oh, I really want to write about this, but my memory is a little bit fuzzy? Did you have that experience at all?
I did several times, and what you do there, at least what worked for me, because I try not to make up too much, because I do want it to still be a memoir and be based on fact and truth, just for my own satisfaction. Obviously, readers wouldn't know the difference, but for me, I would make up little bits of dialogue. Like I wouldn't have known what the dialogue between my parents were in a certain situation, but I could see and hear the voices and hear the various words and know their various interactions. So I could make up little snippets of dialogue that would have been probably pretty close to, I hope, the conversation that took place. Or there were little bits like that I had to, but most of it I recall. Obviously, not the exact dialogue, but the gist of the conversations that I had, for example, with my relatives in Jerusalem, with my relatives in Hawaii. Those are more clearly in my head. But what I couldn't really remember, I think you can have a license to make up as long as it's not too far-fetched and really going to change if you want to stay true to the memories. And I really didn't want to make up too much.
So
I
you're
really
really
wanted it
drawing
to
on
be.
some of those fiction techniques, aren't you? In you bringing the dialogue in. Were there other kind of aspects of fiction writing that you feel that you brought into the writing of the memoir?
Well, the dialogue was very important. You're absolutely right, because in the beginning, when I first wrote it down, I didn't have hardly any, not nearly as much dialogue. So that when I went back on rewrite after rewrite, I decided this could be dialogue because it would make it come to life more. So that's when I had to make up things, but I didn't create whatever scenes. The scenes were as I remembered it. I just filled in the dialogue. It's really important, I think, also to set an active scene, some action, something that's happening, so that it's not just description, because I tend to do a lot of description and I enjoy doing that, and I like to look around and take things in and then write about them. But I realized you really have to show some action so that the reader can actually experience it with you. So that's when I created dialogue and just active motion, so that people could identify more. I think that was a big part that I hadn't realized when I started how much dialogue I was going to have to insert there.
And of course, you bring in some, and as you say, you do have some description, but it's not overloaded with description. And the description that you have is beautiful in that it's very sensory and it really sets the scene, which I think is so important, particularly when you're talking about places that, a lot of your readers wouldn't be familiar with.
Yeah, I think you have to create the scene, because it's like watching a film. And if it's an exotic place, you want to see all of that stuff. But that's the part that comes easy to me. That wasn't the difficult part, was really getting in the dialogue and writing in the action, more action. That came more difficult. But once I got into it and I decided to put that in, with the help of a couple of course recommendations of editors and things, then I began to see the value of that, having the description but also the action and the dialogue.
You know, you do a beautiful job of it.
Thank you.
Your mother sounded like such a strong, adventurous woman. And as you described her, she wanted to explore the world. She wanted the bigger stage, if you like, than where she grew up. And both before and after her death, you were surrounded also by very strong women. And I think, apart from your mother, the women who you met and grew up with in Tehran and Kuwait and in your time in the Middle East, We have this kind of misconception in a way, don't we, about gender roles, I think, in the West, the gender roles that do exist in Middle Eastern countries. Can you talk a little bit about that and your experience of that and how women definitely do have strong roles in those societies?
I was very fortunate that I had some excellent role models, both in, I had a housekeeper lady who became almost a mother figure once my mom died. And she was a village woman from the Mount of Olives. But although she was confined by her role almost as a woman, but still she really ran the whole house and had her own opinions, told me stories of village life and things that were for an illiterate woman. She was an amazingly strong person. And so she was a big influence. My aunts, my father's sisters, also each ran their own households. And they took extremely good care of me when I go to visit them over the summer. And one aunt in particular came and lived with us for a while after my mom had passed away. And they ran also the house, not only the house, just our lives. I can't imagine having carried on without the kind of love and support that I found from my Arab, the caretaker, and as well as the relatives I had, whether they were my dad's cousins or my uncle's wives or my aunts, his sisters. There was a lot of support, although I was dreadfully lost. The loss was unfathomable of losing my mother. And before that, my young brother, they saved me, really. They brought me the support and the love that I needed. But yes, Arab women are very strong. Their roles may be more around the home and the family because people tend to have larger families and homes. But of course, that's changing now. Women are all working and going out like they do anywhere else. But even when I was growing up, the women were very influential and no one told them what to do. They did as much as they could, depending family to family, right?
Yeah.
Like everywhere. But yeah, they're very strong. And I would say mostly it was the love and support I got that got me through my 2 or 3 years of real grief over my mom. Mm-hmm. And the interesting thing was they always took my mother as a Western woman who did her own thing. No one ever tried to make her do or be anything she wasn't. They all respected that. Jean was like that because that's where she comes from.
Yeah.
And my mother always respected them, but she could see they were strong women, but she never tried to influence them or make them into what they weren't. It was a total acceptance, I think, of each other, of their different entities, and yet how they all interacted.
Really?
It seems like I'm painting a super rosy picture, but I think my mother wasn't very religious, although she came from a very religious area in the United States. She wasn't really dogmatically into anything much, was able to accept many things. And my family, coming from Jerusalem, exposed to Islam, Judaism, Christianity for so long, they were able to accept her.
Yeah, really fascinating. I don't want to give away too much of the story, but you've mentioned the passing of your mother when you were young and prior to that, your brother. And of course, I think for me in the reading of it, that kind of really informs a lot of the story. You wrote this obviously a long time after those passings. And as someone who lost a parent when I was young, my father died when I was 3. And even though I have no memory of him, I do know that grief that you grow up with in your family is very informative. It definitely has an impact on you and your kind of formation of who you are as a person.
Yes.
Did you find that writing about those experiences such a long time after that there was still processing going on for you in terms of that grief that you experienced when you were younger?
That's a really nice question. Even though it was so long after, whenever I'd come to the part in the story of my mother's passing, I would have to leave the work and get up and just go do something else for a few hours or maybe a whole day. Mm. And then I'd come back to it. And so that was a way of processing, even though I thought I had processed it years before. When I came to actually write it and recreate that scene of her passing in the hospital and how it affected me then, it was very painful. I would guess for about 12 or 13 rewrites.
Wow.
And then after a while, it becomes almost like someone else's story,
Yeah.
and you can get a distance. But initially, it was extremely painful. I'd come there and I'd just stop. I wouldn't cry or anything. I would feel paralyzed.
And was
Yeah.
that, it would have been after your father's death that you were writing that too, I imagine.
I started it before he died, actually.
Okay.
I started it before he died, but I hadn't gone but a third of the way through, or even less than that. Something I really regretted later, because all the questions I had that were I would have loved to pick up the phone and call him and ask
Yeah.
him, but I realized he was not there anymore, and he was the holder of the family history in many ways. But probably after he passed, I felt a little more freedom to write it. I may have felt always conscious of what he was going to think about this, and maybe he was not going to like the way I wrote about this or that. The fact that he had passed, when I really got into the writing, it was just during COVID, actually. I think that freed me somewhat. Not to write things he wouldn't have been happy about, but just freed me to tell the story my way and not really in the back of my mind wondering how he was going, because nobody but me really at that point cared about the story. He was gone, and he was the only one who really had lived through those years with me.
Yeah, true. But I guess you would have been grieving his death too as you were writing and then reliving the death of your mother. So it was would have been very powerful for you, I imagine, doing that writing. Really interesting. So I just wanted to go back, I guess, full circle to the dance aspect and the music aspect. What was it about the music and the dance for you that came from your childhood that then, I guess, carried on through the rest of your life and became such a strong and powerful theme in the story itself, because it really bookends the memoir. You start and end with the dance in a way, and it weaves its way through the story. Where did that love of dance and music come from?
My dad, strangely enough, he came from Jerusalem, where obviously the music he heard was Arabic music. But when he came to college here, on a whim, he took a few ballroom dance lessons. And it was during the 50s, or no, the late 40s, actually, 50, early 50s and late 40s. And the Latin dancing was a big craze here. Everyone was doing the Caribbean dancing, the mambo, the Cuban stuff. It was that time. And so both my parents got into that. And of course, I think he was probably the better dancer in a sense, because he'd been at that training. But that continued with him. So when I remember as a 4-year-old, 5-year-old, just being a little girl, and he was playing this music all the time. And it was all mostly Latin music by various artists, but his favorite was Harry Belafonte, who was a Jamaican singer and did a lot of course, that's not Latin per se, but it's Caribbean. And that was his favorite music. And so he would on weekends he would put that on, and they would have company and people would dance, and I would dance with them as a little girl. And that continued after Tehran, after Kuwait, that just continued. And as an adult, when raising children and writing books, I just had no time to think of anything else. So I didn't really, I took the odd dance class here and there just for my own enrichment, but I really hadn't gotten back into dance in any significant way. And I decided at some point, I've got to get away from the computer and the way the writing is just too confining. I need to get out and do something different. And I started to take a few dance classes here and there. And it all came flooding back. And it came flooding back. This was the music I loved, the Latin, the cha-cha, the rumba, the samba, the calypso of Harry Belafonte. And I just was hooked. And that sort of opened my life to a whole new, not only a whole new activity, which was dancing now, because I started to take ballroom classes and go out social dancing, but it also opened me to a whole new milieu of people, because there were all kinds of international people, not only Latinos, but the Russians and Eastern Europeans and everybody who was into dance. And so I met people I never would have crossed paths with in my other fields, my writing or meeting the parents of my children's friends, or
Yeah.
this was a whole new milieu of people. So that really broadened my horizons even more.
such a great creative release too, isn't it? And creative experience.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. So
it really is and fun because you can't go on the dance floor and not be laughing or enjoying yourself. So that I think it's a great stress buster.
Catherine, you finished the memoir to some extent. I won't go into the epilogue because that's for readers to find out. But you do finish the main part of the memoir when you're still in the Middle East, still at school. I'm curious, how was it that you ended up back in the States?
Well, interesting. I had never planned on coming back to the States, but when I got married very young at 19, my husband and I were in college in the American University of Beirut, and he is a few years older than I am. So he had graduated and was coming to the U.S. to continue to do his master's. And I was halfway through my undergraduate degree, and I decided, again, it was basically my idea, that it would be a good idea if we got married and we came together. So initially, we came just for 2 years, ostensibly, to finish our studies and go back to Beirut. We were living in Lebanon, and it was a lovely place to live. Our families were there.
Yeah.
But a few years after we came and we finished our degrees, the civil war started there in the early 70s. And so our parents said, stay a couple more years in the United States, and let's see what's going to happen with the situation here. And of course, the Lebanese civil war dragged on for 15 more years. So by that time, my parents and his parents left Lebanon, went to Jordan, was no longer safe or tenable to, it was untenable to stay in Beirut. And so we ended up just staying year after year in the United States. And then we had our children, and then they got in schools, and then it just happened. We never had envisioned that we would come back and live in the United States. It just wasn't part of our plan.
Yeah.
But life takes you.
And did your father stay over there?
He and my stepmom, because he remarried, they stayed in Beirut. They went back to Beirut a few years when the situation calmed down, but then it got really bad. So then they came to the United States. And they settled near us, near Washington. So then we were all here as a family, my parents and my nuclear family. Yeah, we all ended up back in Washington, which we never, any of us expected.
Yeah, almost full circle.
Yeah, you know.
Any plans to write more memoir?
I am writing the next phase. This one will be more like little essays, but rather than a linear thing, they will be just different parts of more my adult life. So I do talk about how it was when I did go to boarding school somewhat, and then how I lived as an adult. We went back and lived in the Middle East overseas with my husband's job and various things. But it'll be more of a series of essays on different, when I say essays, I mean creative nonfiction.
Yeah.
So I have already, I'm about, I don't know, a fifth of the way through.
Great. Look forward to that.
And thank you so much.
Something I also wanted to ask you, as somebody who spent a lot of all your formative years in that part of the world, I imagine that it would have given you quite a strong understanding in some ways of the conflict, particularly obviously it's escalated again now.
It's a very bad time. Yeah.
And that you do mention that throughout the memoir, the background there. Do you think growing up in that part of the world has given you an understanding of both sides of the issue?
Oh, most definitely. Also because my father's Arab as well, and he's Palestinian. So, of course, all that history I was aware of it. It wasn't, my father's family per se was not all that political or in any way, but things happening all around you. And of course, because I spoke Arabic, my mother insisted when I was young that I learn Arabic, and she put me in this little village girls' school. So I learned it quite quickly. I think when you also learn a language well and you're immersed in that culture, you pick it up. You pick up the identity of that culture, right? It's not just you see it from the outside. You really become part of it. And I feel always not torn. I'm always very more sympathetic with the Middle Eastern side because that's where the problems are, right? We don't have all that many problems in the United States, but I'm very sympathetic to the plight of people who are in need or in unfortunate situations like what's happening in Gaza now and this It's just very sad, very hard, really, very
Yeah,
hard.
it is. And
Yeah.
such long historical roots, isn't it? It's a whole
Yes.
situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Catherine, it's been so lovely chatting to you. And I have to say, it was such a beautiful memoir to read. And I highly recommend it to all the listeners out there, particularly anybody who is interested in writing memoir, because I think it's a lot of the listeners of the podcast are writers. And I think you do such a beautiful job of turning those life experiences into a really lovely story. It reads just so beautifully.
I could just add one thing is
Yes, please.
For writers, not to be so intimidated about writing a memoir, because it seems to have a big landscape. But if you pick a theme, like I was suggesting, I did with the dance, and just narrow it down, I would encourage almost anyone to write a memoir, because it's looking back, it's so fulfilling to see that you've enabled other people to see a life as it was lived then. So don't be intimidated. You can find a way of telling your story. It may not be the way I chose, but it will be your way.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And I've written little bits and pieces of fragments, sort of stories, I guess, of my life, and poems in particular, I guess, about
oh,
different
beautiful.
things in my life. But I have to say, reading Dancing into the Light really did make me think about writing some nonfiction, actually. So thank you for that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah.
I read a lot of Australian things too. So I can identify with a lot of that, because we lived in the desert too. There's some stories about the living in the desert and the hardships and all that. And I can relate to that a lot.
For sure. Catherine, a question I always like to end with, and this is interesting in terms of someone who's written a lot of fiction and now working on some nonfiction and having written the memoir. The question that I like to ask at the end is, what do you think is at the heart of your writing?
Oh my goodness. The heart of my writing, I think, is just trying to express what's inside of us, that we're all basically human beings. We all can communicate. We all can solve our conflicts. We all can learn to appreciate each other. I think in most of my writing, now when you ask that question, it's always two cultures coming together and how they overcome their differences and learn to coexist and thrive. And I think that's something the world needs more of. And whether you write about I've written about a marriage where two people are of the same culture, but they're radically different in how they find a way of resolving that, or if they're two cultures, differing lovers from different cultures, and how they resolve that. And I just think that at the heart of my writing is trying everybody to get along and to realize the richness of life is in our variety and our differences, once we learn how to we cherish those and thrive.
I love that, and I can definitely see that in Dancing into the Light. Congratulations
on
the memoir. And where can listeners, anybody that's interested in reading Dancing into the Light or your fiction, whereabouts can they find those books, Catherine?
Oh, they're all on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com, if you have that, or you can order them from any bookstore, really. But if people find Amazon, some people like to order from Amazon, some people don't. But that's one place. You can just Google my name and they'll all come up, all my books.
Fantastic. And I'll put your website in the show notes too, so people can look you up there. And are
Thank
you on
you.
Social media as well, Catherine, if people want
I am.
To follow you?
Yes, it's Catherine Abdulbaki. I'm on social media. I'm on Facebook mainly and Instagram.
Yep, great. I'll put that in the show notes as well.
Thank
so
you.
much for this
Thank
chat.
You.
It's been absolutely lovely and really enjoyed the book, as I said. And I look forward to reading some of your fiction and your essays when they come out.
Thank you. This has been a real extraordinary privilege. Thank you so much.